Hey, it's Callie Jansen, the news director here at WIQH. In the last episode of Cue the Culture, the Intersections Club dove into the English curriculum, discussing how to address race in the classroom with guests from the English department. This week, the club is joined by Mr. Gauthier, Ms. Fox, and Mr. Rivera of the Social Studies department. In a substantial dialogue, the group takes on decolonizing the curriculum, lack of Black, Indigenous, and person of color representation among staff, and the ways in which we can improve upon that, and other issues specific to CCHS surrounding classroom environment and the ways in which we teach race, gender, and sexuality. If you'd like to keep up with the club after listening, you can find them on Instagram at CCHS Intersections. Enjoy the show!
Hi everyone, welcome back to our fourth episode of Cue the Culture, and today we're here with a few social studies teachers, Mr. Rivera, Ms. Fox, and Mr. Gauthier. We'll first do a few quick introductions if it's your first time listening. My name is Vicky.
I'm Stephanie.
I'm Akshaya.
I'm Joseph.
And I'm JJ.
So we're here to talk with the social studies teachers today, kind of like a follow-up from last 2 weeks' episode with the English teachers, where we just talk about the curriculum and some thoughts that we have. We just want to say, like, we're not attacking the curriculum at all or, like, anything that we've learned, because we acknowledge a lot of thought goes into it and a lot of preparation. But we just think, like, especially during this time of reflection, there's always something that can be improved on, and that's just, like, what we're really here doing. And a lot of the opinions or thoughts that we bring up today have also been talked with some other students. So we recently held a discussion with club members, and we did something really similar to here, where we just kind of talked about, like, things in the curriculum that students have thoughts about, and maybe, like, recommendations or just their thoughts in general. So yeah, that's kind of a little preface to this whole episode. I guess I can ask the first question. So really, like, the first thing we want to hear about would be how the social studies curriculum is formed, just like a general idea of it, like, how are the rules, like, state requirements or, like, school requirements that you could speak on?
Should I start? Go ahead, Sam.
Okay. I think, so the state standards created by the Department of Education with input from educators, parents, students, are around the state over the years. The last iteration was 2018. It's gone through several iterations. And so for us, that's one of the things that we consider when we think about what we're required to teach. We also think about it in terms of what we want students to walk away with. If a student is graduating, what are the skills from our discipline? What are the frameworks from our discipline that we want students to have? And most students take world cultures and US history and then take a series of electives, as you know. So some of what we do is try to build in certain frameworks to provide a foundation in world cultures. And Mr. Rivera can talk more about that because he's taught it for years. And US history. But then rather than having an essentialist model where you have to learn specific facts, we emphasize choice in the elective program for juniors and seniors so that students have a chance to explore a variety of aspects of social studies and to hopefully find something they love and become passionate about, and that they find meaning in studying. And so it's a balance of providing some basics, basic foundations in the first 2 years, and then giving students a choice in the latter 2 years. I don't know if you all want to add anything to that.
Well, from the world culture perspective, we follow the same model, as Ms. Foxmore already said.
you know, Callie, you had a nice inside position being the TA this year. So Callie spent the whole second semester kind of relearning and I think enjoying the second semester curriculum. But yeah, we go by the state standards. World Cultures is a difficult course because of so much dense material over a short period of time. So it is truly a top layer survey class that we run. You know, we re-examine the curriculum, like every 3 years tends to be our re-examination period because it takes 3 years to really get to know a curriculum to teach it decently. So that's why we give ourselves that 3 years and then we reconvene. I would say we have been very active. You know, I really love the people I work with and very conscientious. And we realized probably about 5 years ago, it was a very Eurocentric curriculum. And so we changed it. We needed to make it more world. And I you know, there's the thing is we have a lot of creative input and discussion. So, you know, we just had a discussion and, you know, one of us was like, hey, this is very Eurocentric. Let's expand it. And we did. And that's where we started, starting off with China, and we incorporated India, and then we threw in the human condition unit. And then we realized this through, you know, geopolitical circumstances, what needs to be emphasized. So we did more on the Islamic world, for example, and its influence today. So we follow the guidelines, but we also try to make responsible choices based upon what's happening in the world. And like, for example, the last 2 years prior to this resurgence of Black Lives Matter, which is amazing that it has happened, grotesque on how it actually happened. But we, before this happened, we realized we have to do more with the Middle Passage. We have to do more with the Transatlantic Slave Project. And we did, and you can see it in the hallway. We decided to make it a very creative endeavor. So I'm proud of the fact that we do re-examine it. We don't ignore what's going on in the world. We know that we have to constantly, especially with the world cultures, it's so broad, unlike the very specific guidelines that U.S. has to go through. So that's pretty much how we do it. It's a collaboration. It's voices that are heard. I mean, yes, do we need more minority voices in the school? Sure, we do. But I do think with the people that we have now, we're always reexamining. I can show you an email chain about everything that we have ideas about as world culture teachers about what is the next phase? What do we need to do? So we're active, we engage, and can we do more? Of course. I also say, I don't want to get too carried away here, but a wholesale change as a reactionary type of thing is also, I think, counterproductive to the educational process. So I don't want to just jump into something because we think we have to. I like to really examine it and think about it and almost walk away from it because I get so emotionally invested into the topic of racial justice. So it's good for me to walk away and then think about it later.
Just to add a different way to, or just to augment what's already been said, I think it's true that that we do consistently look at or audit our curriculum or sort of always working on it. But you had asked the question, you know, sort of where does this come from? And to some extent it does come from the state, although those frameworks have changed a lot over the years. If you look at the most recent iteration of them, stuff like busing in Boston, which wasn't on those frameworks before, is now on those frameworks. It's positive development. It's a good thing. And maybe we can talk more about how we teach topics like that later on. But I think another thing to bear in mind when it comes to how we arrive at the curriculum that we teach is that every new teacher comes in and confronts a sort of institutional history about the way things have been taught in the past. And we're always, I think there's always this tension between, you know, what was done before and in what ways do we need to update this? And when you're a new teacher, you're coming in and you don't have a whole lot of capital and you're kind of being socialized into this new department. And there's this, I think people come in with things they want to do, but then there's also this sort of tension between that and here are the things that the school has been doing for a long time. It's a healthy tension because I think oftentimes what happens is, you know, people come in and they're allowed some room to inject their interests into the curriculum. Doesn't always lead to some of the wholesale changes that maybe we need to make. But you know, again, there's this institutional history you kind of have to fit in with. So there's that. Okay. So if you look at our curriculum right now, it still very much bears the stamp of a particular teacher. I think Sam would know who I'm talking about here, Kevin Harding, who really taught the class, you know, going way back as sort of a foreign policy class, really looking at the Cold War. And so we do a lot of that. And over time, we've tried to move away from that a little bit. But he was so influential, it kind of set that framework. I think the other thing I'll say, just two other points. I think the second point is all teachers come in with a certain kind of paradigm about history. You know, we learn it from textbooks. We learn it from, you know, our college classes. I think the curriculum reflects our commitment to a certain set of stories that we've been taught, whether we've reflected on it or not. And the more we can be pushed to examine those things that we assume are important stories, and I think be held to account that maybe we need to rethink some of those assumptions, the better. That's a really good thing. So a conversation like this is a really good thing, and that it gets us to think, okay, maybe we're kind of locked into a certain way of seeing this or a certain kind of commitment. And for a teacher, that makes sense. Once you get a kind of story down and you develop a lesson around it that works, it's really hard to want to deviate that from that because it takes a lot of work and there's a lot of investment into doing it a certain way. And so every time you talk about adding something in, you also have to think about why that might be scary for a teacher, right? Maybe it's representing a curriculum that they're unfamiliar with or a story they don't know very well. I know for me, sometimes I think about sort of decolonizing my curriculum a little bit. I always wonder to myself, boy, can I represent the voices, you know, of this group or that group effectively? How do I do that? You know, I don't want to do that. You know, I want to do it, but I want to do it in a really respectful kind of way. And that sometimes can lead me to sort of overthinking things sometimes. So I think we all come with the stories that we want to tell, which again are framed by some of the same sort of larger forces, our textbooks, our culture. And sometimes I think we're not always aware of the way that then feels to students who may feel marginalized in the particular ways in which we do tell those stories. Again, necessitating conversations like this. So there's an institutional history. I think we come with our prepackaged sense of what's important as well. So that I think that those are other factors to consider. One other thing I'll say along with what Sam said about the U.S. curriculum, there is this need to have a sort of standard U.S. curriculum. One of the nice things, though, is that different teachers are allowed to, within that framework, sort of explore some of their interests. So, for example, Ms. Fisher uses a lot of movies, right? Ms. McGee, who has this history she had worked for Charles Schumer, Senator Schumer in New York. So she brings a certain sense of the legislative process that's different than other people. Mr. Hobblesell's got this cultural history piece that's really cool. Mr. Kendall is constantly reworking things and trying to engage students by connecting history to things that are going on in the present. So Ms. Fox Morrow brings in the 20s based on her own research from graduate school, I believe. Sam, I'm saying that correctly, right? So there's some room to maneuver within, and so there's a little bit of variation. But we also have to have a certain story that is in common for all the students as well. So it is sort of a collective thing, as Mr. Rivera was saying. We kind of work on it together, which sometimes when making a change means everyone kind of has to agree. So that can be a tough process too.
I would also just add that I think history itself isn't static. So there's always new histories being written. And then when we read them, we reconceptualize how we think about things. So I was this summer reading a book about Ona Judge with my daughter. I got the young reader's version for my 12-year-old. And we read it together as a sort of grandmother, mother-daughter book club. And so, but for that, you know, she hadn't, I'm not an expert on presidential history. That would be Miss Davies, or on George Washington in particular. But the extent to which he hunted down and tried to recapture his slaves while maintaining his reputation was something that I learned this summer. I had always known he was a slaveholder. I had always known that he had slaves. I knew that there were slaves who escaped. The extent to which he and his wife, Martha, actually tried to hunt down and recapture those who escaped was something that wasn't wasn't something that I knew in a lot of detail. And so as you read new books that are coming out, it does help you reframe and reconceptualize the stories that you were told when you were in high school, that we learned in graduate school, and that we bring to the curriculum. And that's part of the reason why, as Mr. Rivera said, every few years we sit down and say, do we need to make some changes? What are we doing that we like? What are we doing that needs some changes? How do we rework what we need to in order to teach it better? So I think that idea that history is always changing is really central to how we conceive of the process.
If I can add again, just adding on to that, I also think our personal experience is a big part of it. And I think that's what we are trying to imply here. You know, for example, when I talked about the Middle Passage earlier, that was something I did on my own. I took that initiative. I wanted to do this experiential piece where I wanted to force a kind of white upper class Concord Carlisle type kid to be inside the mind and body of a slave that was captured and taken across the Atlantic. And that's from my personal experience, because I've always been quite intimidated by the whiteness of our school. And I thought that the best way to kind of deal with that was to show that I'm not white, that I'm different. And it's a good thing that we have differences. So, and what was cool about it, you know, some of the older teachers didn't like it, but the younger ones did. And it became a big project. But I did it 15 years ago. It didn't get co-opted, mainstreamed into our curriculum until about 5. So there's a process too. And I was a young teacher, and Mr. Goff is 100% correct. I haven't established any capital. No one knew what I did. I was known as a wrestling coach, not as an academic. And that also motivated me too, from a stereotypical point of view, as a Hispanic male. I wanted to be seen as an academic, not as a jock. I've been fighting that my whole life. To this day, I still have to fight it with other colleagues that I respect. So when you come in as a minority into the school as a teacher, it is overwhelming. So I imagine that's why we're talking, and I'm looking at the faces here. I see why this is a conversation, because I'm sure many of you have felt intimidated by the dominant white culture at CC. So I also think the experiences, and not that all Hispanic males have had my experience as well. I'm a New England Hispanic that moved to the South. That's crazy. It really is. And married a white girl from the South who comes from money. So that was just the whole assimilation process has been a fascinating one, which absolutely, I know Callie has had me in class, and so has Akshaya. It spills into the classroom. That's why I think, and I'm so delicate with this statement, because I have so much love and deep admiration for the people I work with. But this is why I have decided, as when pandemic happened and all of these horrible atrocities to African Americans took place, I need to advocate for more minority teachers. It is an absolute imperative that this school has embraced when I stood up there and said, this is what we need. But it does make people uncomfortable. And I don't want to make my colleagues uncomfortable. They're amazing human beings that always, always advocate for social justice. It gets me emotional thinking about it. So how do you do that, right? And I think that's the challenge. How do you say, we need more minority teachers, but there's nothing wrong with you? I think that's so difficult. And I am always walking that line. I don't want to offend. I don't want to upset. I've been in so many angry states of mind. I don't want that. So it's, I think that's the other point to this question that you may have are trying to get to. It's also the interpretation of the material because of the individual's life circumstances. And that's what makes people drawn to certain teachers. And we know that people are drawn to, you know, Miss Fox Murrow and Gossier, because they're just these charismatic people that care so deeply. So that's the challenge. How do we get more minorities into the school as teachers? Because that's what I think is the number one issue at our high school, without offending the amazing teachers that are there. And we can't blame them for being born white. It's the same thing that people do to us. So it's, I don't know, man. It's a tough one.
I think Mr. Rivera's, you know, hit the nail on the head with that. I think that there is, I think about what Joseph said in the roundtable discussion. You know, it's one thing to offer jobs to candidates of color. It's another thing to ask the question, why don't they want to come? In fact, I believe that a woman of color was offered the job that I eventually took. She was offered it, but she didn't come. And I think, as Mr. Rivera is saying, there are some pretty good reasons why it might be really intimidating to come into a place like Concord, as white as it is, especially when white teachers don't see that, right? They see it as a neutral space. What, there's nothing about race here? It's funny how you can walk into a place that's almost entirely white. If you're a white person, be like, oh, there's nothing about race here, right? If you were to walk into a place that was entirely black, right? So somehow that would be a racial space, but Concord isn't, at least to a lot of white people. I think it's strange. So I think a much more proactive approach to actually trying to make it a more hospitable place, trying to create some incentives to bring teachers in, to try to make it a more welcoming place. That's, and again, to be proactive about it, not to just, you know, keep on extending job offers and then scratching our heads when people don't take them, but actually saying, wait a minute, maybe we need to make some changes in the message that we're sending about the way in which we're going to support people, right? In the ways in which we're going to facilitate their development and their career development. And it's not just going to be one person, it's going to be a lot of people, right? Because no one wants to be just one person, right? And then going back to something else that Mr. Rivera said, I think it's important to note that just when you think about this, one of the coolest things I get from my peers is the way in which I steal their lesson plans. Okay, I'll admit it, I do. And it's great because I've got these great teachers and they come up with these great lesson plans. And sometimes my lesson plan stinks and theirs is better and I take it and then I don't give them credit. I'm joking, I give them credit. But it's me, it was all me. No, but I think about, you know, I think about things like I took the Invasion of the Body Snatchers. You guys remember watching this in US history, right? What an interesting way to think about the Cold War and McCarthyism, right? I got that from Fisher. I think about things like, again, another Cold War lesson, the building of the cards, right? To talk about McCarthyism again, I got that from McGee, okay? You know, presidential stuff I've stolen from Davies. There's stuff from the 20s I've snatched from Fox Murrow, haha, right? But think about what Rivera is saying. Imagine, though, then what would happen if our faculty became more diverse and then we have people in the department creating lessons, right? I can take from them too. Might those lessons look a little different? Might that be great for me and for my students, not just for the people that teacher is teaching, right? But I only stand to become a better teacher from that experience as well. So I guess one question I would throw out there is, what does the faculty at CC need to give up? What sense of dominance, what sense of security do we need to give up in terms of making more space for those teachers, making more space for those stories, right? Because with everything you add something else, there's only so much time, only so many jobs. The hard reality is it's one thing to say we love diversity, let's include more, but there are limitations. And so we have to also be willing to give something up. It's hard, but we have to.
Yes, thank you guys for answering that question. So the next question I was going to ask was brought up in the discussion we had on Friday with some of the students. And some of them felt as if when they were in, you know, U.S. history and they were learning about the history of the United States, that some people and some cultures weren't really viewed that at all. Like, for example, with the LGBTQ community, a lot of people felt as if we never talked about Stonewall. We never mentioned Marsha P. Johnson. And I kind of relate to that because as being gay myself, it was kind of like, I learned about all these civil rights activists and I was so happy to learn about, you know, the people who fought for Black rights and, you know, for people to and use their voice during that time. But then like afterwards, it was such a shock to me when I was learning about, you know, myself, learning through like internet, through like Instagram, stuff like that, about LGBTQ history, because I didn't know anything about Stonewall. I didn't know who Marsha P. Johnson was. So when I finally learned about it, and learned about how they were so unapologetically just like gay and didn't have anyone like take their voice away from them. It was such like a, you know, it was able for me to like really be comfortable with myself and not be ashamed of myself. And I think that a lot of people at CC not just gay people, but also like, you know, people who are Asian, people who are Native American, feel as if, you know, if the curriculum kind of just touched a little bit on their history, you know, outside of like maybe the sad things that happened to them, they could feel as if they were more connected versus learning about people they don't connect to. So I guess the question is like, how do you think you could include that in the curriculum, and what would be hard about doing that?
So I can speak to the first semester because that's what I teach, and then maybe Mr. Gauthier can speak to the second semester a little bit. Is that okay, Chris?
Yeah.
So thank you for that question, Joseph. And I think looking at the multiplicity of voices and perspectives in the American community is always something we struggle with in United States history, because not only are we looking for a variety of perspectives, but we're also looking, as Mr. Rivera said when he said, "I don't speak for all Hispanic men," that we can't just pick one person and say this person's experience is representative for an entire group. So when you're picking case studies, or when you're looking at someone's biography, they speak, they're connected to their group, but they're not always a spokesperson for or representative of the experiences. So that said, I think we try to build it in at different times, but we probably could do a better job of being more consistent about it. So, for example, I remember talking about a little bit of when we did immigration about some of the discrimination against LGBTQ folks who were trying to come into this country as the immigration service was developing in the early 20th century. But prior to the popularization of Freud, sexual identity wasn't generally, if you look at the 19th century, at the forefront of people's articulated identities. So there are people who are clearly same-sex oriented, who love people of the same sex, but they didn't define themselves primarily as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer, right? So for that particular example, and then what happens is, at least in this country, in response to some of the federal discrimination, starting in the immigration service and then moving over into the military, some of the same people that...
Oh man. Sam.
She may have to reboot.
You might have to reboot. Yeah. Joseph, do you want me to kind of pick it up while we're waiting for her to log back on?
Yeah, pick it up.
What Ms. Flaxmore was saying is actually something I touch on quite a bit in my sociology class. You know, this question of homosexuality as an identity versus just a, you know, preference, right? Is there actually a relatively new thing? And there's a whole history there that's actually really worth knowing. Also, psychiatry's relationship with sexuality. In fact, one story that I really want to add to my U.S. history curriculum is, how did we end up extracting homosexuality as a psychosis from the DSM, I believe it's DSM-3, right, which happened in the 1960s. It was a bunch of very committed activists within the medical community who worked very, very hard. Maybe I should back up. You guys know that homosexuality was actually listed as a psychiatric affliction, right, in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. I'm probably not telling you anything you don't know. But how did it actually end up getting taken out, right? So, Joseph, I think what you were saying, and I think I take this very much to heart, the stories that we tell about, populations that aren't, you know, straight, white, able-bodied men, right, shouldn't always be stories of oppression and victimization, but I think also stories of resilience and contribution and so forth and so on. And here we have one of both, right, where we can both talk about the fact that sexuality was considered to be, you know, a psychiatric illness, but then also sort of the heroism of getting it removed from that, which didn't just happen because people thought, oh, we were wrong scientifically. No. That there was a much, you know, it was about gathering together, it was essentially a social movement within the world of psychiatry. That's an incredible story. that probably needs to be told. And I'll also just mention another piece about this, and we can go back to Ms. Fox-Murray. I'll just say that, you know, when you think about history, one way I like to think about it is, you know, you think about the story of history. And again, history is political. I don't mean all history is political history. The telling of history, whose story you're going to represent, is a political thing. It's a contested thing. Whose story gets to be the story, right? And, you know, again, that's a whole question. And obviously, oftentimes, it's the dominant groups whose story we tell. And that, you know, that's again, you know, we think about history as kind of like a colonized thing. How much is our history colonized by powerful people telling their story? There are lots of ways to tell U.S. history. How much of it is just the you know, history is those who you know, have been in power would like it to be told. So, you know, I guess when we talk about this, what we're talking about really is decolonizing history, right? Considering history from the perspectives of those who haven't been in control. This is, by the way, this is a really fascinating way to think about history. It's why people read books by Howard Zinn. What's that book, Lies My High School History Teacher Told Me, whatever. These books are interesting to read because they reveal that there are lots of different ways to tell the story of history. But I tend to think about history as like a ray of light. And you think about that one unitary ray of light is like the dominant story of history. But we know light is made up of a lot of different colors, right? And what happens when we begin to think about that beam of light? What happens when we consider that story, but we say, wait a minute, what if we refract this story through the prism of gender? Okay, how does that change the story, right? And then you can trace that line out and say, okay, if I were a woman, this history might look like this. Then we can refract it through race. We can say, well, if I were Hispanic, right, it might look like this, right? I do some work on Los Angeles in the Cold War, a class that I really like about the Dodgers in a place called Chavez Ravine, where you get to sort of consider that question, right? You could even ask the question of what is the telling of any particular history that we hold up, we refract it through the question of being able-bodied, right, or ableism, right? And what you see is that history, as that one beam of light, can be endlessly refracted. So you think about something like the Cold War, Joseph, you go back to, we think about, talk about McCarthyism, you know, one of the things I think a lot of us have started to incorporate is the Lavender Scare, which may or may not ring a bell for some of you guys, but the ways in which sexuality was used in the McCarthy trials to, in these hunts for communism, or communists within the State Department, other departments in the government, as an intimidation tool, the way it was used against people, even in the Army McCarthy trials, it was used by both sides, right? Homophobia was, and threats of revealing people's identity, right? And there's a whole interesting history about, you know, there. It makes you wonder, what were the possibilities then for self-liberation around your desires and the people that you love, if the dominant discourse at the time was one that if you were gay, you were somehow un-American and a security threat, right? So when you refract the Cold War through that, you know, through that prism of sexuality, you see something really interesting as well. The one question I'll bring up is, and this is, I think, the thing we bump up against, is there are endless refractions of history. The problem is we only have so much time, right? So sometimes I wonder, maybe our job in U.S. history is just tell that dominant story and keep on saying it's so much more complicated, and then try to leave it up to the electives to then say, you were lied to, or the story is more complicated, right? But that's not a good solution, because obviously we want to be covering, everyone takes all the electives. With sexuality, Joseph, it's a great point. And I'm adding a couple of readings to my soc class in regards to that question. But, you know, with U.S. history, I think we have some more work to do there. Sam, you got cut off. You were like frozen in time.
Sorry. I don't know what the last thing you heard.
Well, you were saying something about how sexuality, people's desires, was not a, sort of the dominant form of identity in the 18th century.
Yeah. So I think, again, I guess the identity started to become more dominant for people who would currently identify as LGBTQ because of two factors, because of psychology, and Mr. Rivera can talk much, much more eloquently on this than I can, but Freudian psychology did become popularized in the American imagination around the time and after World War I. And then secondarily, due to federal discrimination, first in the Immigration Service and then in the military in terms of the draft in World War II. And so those two things, the response to those two phenomena led to a much stronger identity for people who we would now define as, and who would define themselves as in the LGBTQ community. So in the first half of US history, there are inklings. And if you look, for example, at the 19th century, I remember reading about this Southern planter, a white male, who was married and had children and who held elected offices in his county and was a high status individual, and who also had intimate sexual relations ongoing with other men because he loved who he loved. What's interesting in the 19th century is because sexual identity wasn't the dominant form of identity, he was actually defined by his race and his status, and he did not face discrimination because of that status, because he owned property, because he had political clout. As sexuality and sexual and gender identity become more important to individuals in the United States over the course of the 20th century, there also is increasing amounts of discrimination. And then movements in response to that. In terms of the rest of your question, Joseph, dealing with other voices, I think Mr. Gauthier said it beautifully, that there are endless voices and history is inherently selective. And so the hardest thing for us to do, for me to do as a teacher, I shouldn't speak for others, but the hardest thing for me to do as a teacher is to choose how to structure the class, what to focus on in class, and then what to mention in passing. And I think part of what I've done is, I remember talking a little bit about the African-American experience in World War I, talking about the soldiers who fought in World War I, while most of the African-Americans who were sent as part of the American Expeditionary Force in World War I were in supportive positions. There were four units, battalions, who were in combat units. And two of them fought with the French. And some of them were considered so heroic by the French that they were given medals because of their amazing support and fighting, combat fighting with the French army. Some individuals, some entire units, the Croix de Guerre. And so I looked back at it just to see what I did 2 years ago, just because I was curious and I didn't teach it last year. And I have that slide of the Harlem Hellfighters was the French nickname for them, for one of the groups. And I have it there. But the question is, I think what Mr. Gauthier pointed out is, how much do we talk about it? So how do we see the war? Do we discuss the war in the sort of larger terms? And then when we look at the how people experience that large phenomenon, how do we bring in the voices of the suffrage movement? And how do we then look at the suffrage movement and look not just at the white women who ran the major national organizations, Carrie Chapman Catt, Anna Howard Shaw, Alice Paul, but how do we look at Ida B. Wells? At that time, Ida B. Wells Barnett, who was an African-American woman, an anti-lynching campaigner, a journalist, and who founded the Alpha Suffrage Club in Chicago for African-American women. And who, when she was told in 1913 to march at the back of the suffrage march, said, no, not going to happen. And she, instead of marching at the back of the parade where the organizers told her to march, she came in from the crowd and marched with the Chicago delegation. And they welcomed her. So not only looking at sort of the big story of World War I and the causes and the military strategies, but also what the experience was like for the soldiers, what the experience was like for Americans at home, and how do we, I think time is our greatest enemy. And that I think we have to really be thoughtful. I think we have been, but even more so going forward, about those choices that we make and how much emphasis we give to various voices over time. And every unit can't have everyone in it, because I could spend an entire year just teaching about suffrage. Stop laughing, Mr. Rivera. I could do that, but I don't have a year just to teach. We don't have any full year classes, let alone a full year class just on suffrage. So then, you know, we need to have conversations. And I'm glad we're having this conversation with you, as well as with our colleagues, about what we teach and how we teach it and how much time and attention we give to the variety of voices and experiences within the American community. I should say the United States community. American is not the right word.
If I can add on to that, and first off, I would be the first one in line to your women's suffrage class, by the way. It would be amazing.
Thank you, Mr. Rivera.
Mm-hmm. So a couple things. Just from listening, I think, you know, the greater point is it's just that we have to talk about it. You have to kind of, you know, what I tend to do is almost like what Mr. Garthy was saying, but you guys are doing it from the U.S. model perspective. I like to ask the kids, how did this idea of homosexuality even become? Because there really was no line in the ancient world. This really is something that was fabricated by Catholicism. And so I talk about that. You have to talk about how we as human beings behave. And then how does like society standardize that behavior? And then by standardizing it, we create an either or. And then how does that basically get passed on through time? And then we get so inculcated through it, through culture, that we just believe it's a fact, like it's a scientific reality. So, you know, I think with freshmen, it's so important, especially in the human identity movement. We talked about sexuality. I want everyone in that room to feel welcome. I want to normalize everything. Like, people will love who they love. I loved how you said that, Sam. That was great. But that's exactly right. So I think it's really important to create a classroom culture where the students know and feel that who they are, and they may not even know who they are. I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. But that they at least feel these feelings are not going to be something that is viewed against them. So we talk about it constantly. We talk about the dogma of the institution of Christianity or whatever it may be, and how that dogma becomes this cultural force of what is now considered moral. And we attack it. And I want these kids to recognize the subjectivity of what normal and moral actually is. So these are the type, and I also just, I can only speak for myself as well. I enjoy making students uncomfortable. It is something that I enjoy doing. It is something that I think has built me capital at the school. It's something I'm good at. And maybe that's, again, because I come from somewhere a bit different. And I want, you know, we have the saying in freshman world cultures, at least in my class, it's like, how do we make something that's uncomfortable comfortable? We talk about it until it becomes comfortable. So I think that's the bigger issue, is we can specifically say, well, we need to put this in this historical unit in this year. Yeah, we do, without a doubt. But we also have to have a conversation in the classroom that allows people to feel welcome, given whatever their identity is. We do a really good job with that in Twice Told Tales. Mr. Spence and I, when we teach Epic of Gilgamesh, we go right to the relationship between Gilgamesh and Enkidu. And it's not a bro love. It's not like two buddies high-fiving. They are lovers. If you know anything about the story, they are deeply in love. And we talk about that. And I see a lot of the students who have written in their journals, I'm gay, or I don't know what my sexual identity is, but talking about it in class made me feel so normal. Made me feel so just, I don't know, if you feel like you get the loyalty of these students just by actually acknowledging how diverse human condition really is, you know. So we do that especially with ancient Greece. So some we have a bit more opportunity with the curriculum in a twice told tale type class because we create it. It does have standards. We follow all those guidelines, but it's also just, and this goes back to the comfortability of each teacher. How comfortable is the teacher engaging in the conversation that allows the curriculum to expand beyond what is considered the standardization of normal, which is pretty much a white male in the upper class world. You know, they're the ones that write the history in a sense. So I think that's another point to it rather than specific, more so just in a general term. How do we get more comfortable talking about these issues and incorporating it into the classroom setting so we can once again have every voice contribute into a classroom discussion? So I'll
just building on that a little bit, I know you guys have a lot of questions, but I think it's important to also note that I think one of the things, and we joke a little bit about this in the department. If you go back and you look at some of the textbooks from way back when, you know, when we talk about sort of decolonizing the curriculum and considering, you know, the way in which history might be different, we considered, you know, different voices and different social positions and what those interests might be and then how history might sound different. You know, one thing we really want to avoid is sort of telling the standard story and then kind of just tagging on, you know, a little reference here, a little reference there to, you know, to some group's contributions to what is seen as this sort of big, inexorable movement of history. In some textbooks, I took on the quality of at the end of a chapter on, you know, whatever it might be, you know, let's say it was World War II.
It was always suffrage.
Oh, suffrage. Oh, no. Well, I'm thinking this, Sam. I'm thinking the end of a chapter, and the end of the chapter would say, and women and minorities made important contributions too, period. Exactly. Right? I mean, we don't want to have anything to do with that. And so the question becomes not just the inclusion, but what is the quality of that inclusion, right? There are two, it's like the question of segregation or integration versus desegregation. You can desegregate a school by sticking, you know, students together, but that doesn't mean you've got any meaningful interaction between them. That's integration. That's a different standard. So I think we have to also be clear about the kinds of standards that we're holding ourselves to. We don't want to do lip service here. We don't want to just say, oh, you know, check the box and say, oh yeah, we do that because we mention it. Right? If we're going to do it, we want to do it right. We want to do it with some depth. So that's really important. I just wanted to make two other quick points. You know, I'm thinking here about ways in which, you know, we can actually cover, and going back to a point that Joseph made again, just go back to this point, we want to not just talk about oppression, but also celebrate heroes. And sometimes there's, again, ways to do both. I'm thinking about W.E.B. Du Bois here is a favorite of mine. And students hear me talk about this particular fellow a lot because he was a sociologist, which is what my discipline is. He's seen as a founder in sociology, but oftentimes left out of the canon entirely. And Du Bois is notable because, you know, after Reconstruction, for many historians in America, the story told about the 1930s was that Reconstruction had failed because Blacks were given too many freedoms too quickly. That was sort of the standard, and the Ku Klux Klan had somehow been this heroic force, right? I mean, totally absurd, right? We understand that. Who was it that rewrote that history? It was W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote a book in 1935 called Black Reconstruction. That has actually become the story. Eric Foner, famous historian of Reconstruction, David Roediger, you know, labor historian. That's the story we accept now as the story. Du Bois did that. So again, you know, in covering that story, we shouldn't just tell the story of Reconstruction. We need to also attribute that to Du Bois. Consider how heroic it was for him to tell that story, the struggles he had in having that story be adopted, right? These are all little interventions we can make, but they're really, really meaningful. And then one final point I wanted to make that Mr. Rivera made me think about. It's one thing to think about the curriculum. It's another thing to think about kind of in some ways decolonizing our classrooms. Because I imagine that for students of color, you know, students, you know, the LGBTQ community and so forth, that it isn't just the lack of representation in the curriculum. It might also be the classroom culture and environment. Right? So what does it mean to inhabit a largely straight, white, middle-class space? Right. In what ways does the character of the classroom, the assumptions that are made, the meta narratives, the sort of unspoken assumptions about things and the way things ought to be and the way people ought to behave, how loud their voices should be, how they ought to dress, right? Assumptions about people's academic capacities based on their racial profiles. So how much does that stuff pervade our practices, right? And so another thing I think we need to be thoughtful about as teachers is, you know, just from being in there, we shouldn't see our classrooms as neutral spaces. Culturally, they're largely white spaces. And in what ways do those sort of unspoken realities that sort of form a kind of polarity or magnetism that kind of attracts white students in ways I think white teachers don't oftentimes understand and repel other students, right? And then we look at those student struggles and think, well, there's something wrong with this student academically. Maybe that's not right. You know, why does a student come for extra help? You know, maybe that student, you know, doesn't feel like we have the kind of connection, right? Why doesn't that student talk as much? Maybe they're a little more shy in that classroom, especially if they're the only student of color, for example, about the way that might be perceived by their white classmates. When I think about even, you know, idiomatic things teachers will say in a classroom, right? I mean, how many times have you guys been in a classroom a teacher has just used an example that they must have seen as a neutral example, but it clearly spoke to their racial identity? I'm thinking about being in a class a long time ago and some teacher kept on referring to giving mulligans and bogeys. And these are, I found out, golf terms. I didn't play golf. I know what the hell that person was talking about, right? I just wonder how many times in my practice I do things that I see as neutral, but really they're culturally specific to the dominant group in school and the ways in which that serves to exclude students and the ways in which we've kind of enshrined whiteness as the way to be at school and the way that excludes students.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think that, thank you so much for all your words. And we also have some, like, students to speak on those experiences, I guess, and also advice or ideas that students had during our discussion about, like, this topic as well. So if any of you guys have something to say on that. Okay.
Yeah. As you were talking about being like a student of color in a classroom full of like only, or not only, but mostly white students, it can get overwhelming at times. And one thing like I've had like directed towards me is like teachers might single me out to speak on experience. And I think that was like seen in our discussion yesterday too, because a lot of students sometimes feel like being a student of color, they're kind of singled out to speak on a whole race's like experience, which can get not just overwhelming, but you know, you just can't speak on that. So I guess my question to you is like, how do you deal with that? Because you know, for me, it was like really not just like sad, but I was like, oh, maybe I like don't want to talk about this in front of the whole class right now. So yeah.
Well, for me, I just use myself as the example. So it's a little bit, maybe I have that advantage. I get to play my minority card. So by doing that and talking about my experience as a, you know, minority male, grew up in a really difficult household, very rough. It kind of, I think, sets the cultural tone in that classroom that we really can be honest and attempt to be non-judgmental. When I first did the Middle Passage Project, the only kid that had a problem with it was the one African-American kid. And he said exactly what you said. He was like, they don't understand how this hurts me. And we had a really good discussion. And I remember telling him, but you're an African-American male who has been subjected to so many racial injustices by white people. And if I can get these white kids to develop a semblance of empathy for African-American males, is that going to be beneficial for society? And luckily he agreed. And I was lucky about it. It was a very tense situation. But it was more about just kind of maybe having that sidebar conversation with that student. This was new. This was a long time ago. I was probably in my 20s. And, you know, nowadays what I've learned is you have that sidebar conversation with the student beforehand, not in front of everyone. You don't point them out in front of the whole crowd. Hey, talk about your experience of being a black woman. Or what? No, I don't want to. So you don't do that. I think what you do instead is you have to have that conversation with them, but also more importantly, build a culture in the classroom that has established trust. And for me, again, only can speak for me, I make myself very vulnerable in the classroom. I do talk about my past. I want kids that have maybe been abused, neglected, ostracized, discriminated against to look at me and say, hey, maybe that happened to him too. And maybe I can establish a level of congruency with that guy. Maybe I can trust him. And to me as a teacher, that's everything. That's everything. I teach. We used to joke, oh, we're saving lives today, but that was never a joke. It wasn't really hyperbole. I believe that we have the power to really change the way people see themselves and help them navigate through this complicated world with a bit more ease. One more thing I do want to say, because it keeps popping up in my head. What do we have to sacrifice? I keep hearing. And I think one of the things that is so difficult, again, but I've seen this from the very beginning, I think what we as a, have to sacrifice is our own pretentious standardization of academia. It is so intimidating to have a conversation with people, and I'm including students, at Concord Carlisle, to the point in which it's horrifying. When you hear the books that they've read, the way they talk, how they write, how they judge, how they scrutinize, it is really through this very intense, once again, I would just say almost pretentious from a minority perspective. I feel like I'm being overwhelmed and intimidated constantly by intellectualism. And this is not a school thing. This is a Eastern, this is a Massachusetts thing. This is a white, wealthy, suburban thing. So when we ask what we have to sacrifice, that is such a difficult question, because again, when you ask many minorities about the school, it goes from the teachers to the students. Everyone talks about what college they go to, what degrees they have. You know, these are conversations I've never been able to be a part of. What vacations they're going to. Are you going to see your mom and dad? I haven't seen my mom and dad in a decade. These are the type of thing that does ostracize many, many people in our school. So I think what we as a community, this isn't just teachers again, I mean as a community, Concord, Carlisle, Boston, we have to kind of let go of our own just, oh man, sense of superiority. That, yeah, we do go to the best schools. Yeah, and all of it, but you know what? It actually, what it does is attract the same type of people back to the school. And so in a way, I've been a part of many interviewing processes here, and I see the way even resumes are judged by the school, the GPA. There's no wiggle room. There's no, hey, let's interpret this from a more of a global sense. So, you know, again, I do love this conversation, and I'm glad we're having it. But I do think this conversation is even bigger than us. And it is so, oh my gosh, convoluted and deeply rooted into this community. It's why my kids go to the school. Why do my kids go to school? They can go to Marlboro and get a more diverse education. But why do they go here? Because I know it will give them the best economic opportunity for success. So they never have to experience what any of my family ever experienced. So that's the part that I don't know if we're willing to have that conversation. You know, maybe we don't hire people that just go to the best schools all the time. Maybe we actually have to change that standard. I don't know if your parents are going to be cool with that, by the way, students, but this is what we have to do. We have to look at people that come from a different world, different background, ask those difficult questions. And I think that's something that we're just beginning. And I'm very proud to say we are initiating that conversation. But we got a long way to go, man, when it says, what do we have to give up to make a minority person feel comfortable in a school? Got to give up a whole lot of yourself, and that's asking a lot.
Just to jump in here, to go back to Akshaya's point a little bit about like looking to the students to represent the pupils that we're maybe talking about, I think a way to come at this at a different approach other than like assuming students' ethnicity would be to incorporate new ways to convey the information. So something you're a little bit talking about, Mr. Rivera, is like having people with different experiences coming into the school. Maybe if we aren't able to have new teachers come in, but if we had people like documentaries we could watch or like speakers or people from the community, maybe even go on a field trip, which might not be able to right now. But I think another way to bridge that gap would be to incorporate new ways to have this information, because teachers shouldn't be and they aren't expected to know everything. And I guess you guys are all coming from your own perspectives and your own background. So if we weren't able to have
teachers who came from these backgrounds, which maybe we would be able to in a few years, but having new ways to convey the information with people coming in to help represent these peoples.
Yeah. And
Stephanie, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think that we are always trying to bring in new primary sources so that people can speak for themselves. But again, primary sources are one individual voice, and we have to give meaning to that. We have to provide a structure so that that voice has meaning. And I think, so in terms of letting people speak for themselves, I wholly agree with you. And I think it's a little harder in terms of documentaries to do that before film. So really old stuff. I mean, there are documentaries, of course, but in terms of actual people talking on film, since talkies were introduced in 1927, we don't really have that prior. We have certain films. There are actually some films on World War I, but they're not accompanied by sound. And we have music sheets, but phonograph. We have some recordings on phonograph from starting around the 1870s, 1877, I think. But again, so hearing people's actual voices, the second part of the 20th century is a lot easier to do than the earlier part of the 20th century, or certainly before 1927. Because then once you get into a documentary, sometimes it's just a different historian, and it's their frame and it's their interpretation. And sometimes they're as elite or a part of an elite, an academic elite that Mr. Rivera was just talking about. So, but I agree with you in terms of music, art. In the 1920s, for example, when we start looking at art, I've done Jacob Motley. He has done some incredible portraits. He was a Harlem Renaissance artist, and he was exploring the idea of race. And if you look at some of his portraits, the one about his grandmother, and several others, he's trying to convey through some of his art, as were many of the Harlem Renaissance artists, an aspect of his experience. And so when we have art, when we have poetry, when we have music, and when we have film, and if not, we have sometimes the written word. But as Mr. Rivera said earlier, or maybe it was Mr. Gothier talking about, you know, history being written by the winners, when we get to the pre-film era, then if you're looking for primary sources, sometimes you end up prioritizing elite voices because they're the ones who are literate. And so you're toying with all of these things, but I agree with you in large part that letting people speak for themselves, that I am a white teacher. And so if I want to teach more about the American experience, then bringing in W.E. Du Bois's experience or Ida B. Wells, or someone you haven't even heard of who wasn't a leader, who just wrote a letter, or who kept a diary. Those are great tools that we can access to augment the number of authoritative voices within the classroom beyond just ours.
You know, I was thinking about this particular question about a teacher that somehow looks at a student of color as if they're a spokesperson, right? And what's so interesting, I have so many thoughts on this, but I think one thought on this that I'll share with you guys is, can you imagine the converse? Can you imagine, I would love, I've actually done this in my social class just to try to make this point. You know, my graduate work was entirely on race, culture, and immigration. That's what I studied, and so I actually specifically studied white people, right? And it seems like right now in this moment of that we're in historically, it seems like everyone around, every white person around me is like, "Whoa, I'm white,"
I have a race. I'm a racial person. I never knew, right? And this, of course, I'm kind of parodying this a little bit, but this is one of the fundamental things that scholars of whiteness, going back to the 80s, actually came out of the disjunctures in third wave feminism, right? The ways in which women of color within the feminist movement said, this movement doesn't speak to me. You guys aren't talking about gun violence. You're not talking about, you know, homelessness. You're not talking about sex work. You know, you guys are saying that the issues of middle-class white women are the issues of women. You're leaving me out, right? And then that caused a lot of white women within that movement to say, oh, yeah, you're right. It's not, race isn't just, you know, what people are deprived of. The other side of that is race is the ill-begotten gains by the dominant group, okay? And that we need to dissect that. And the problem with white people dissecting that is that is so often what we take to be normal and history and culture is white, but it appears to white people to just be what is, what's normal, okay? And so in my social class, sometimes when it comes to this question that you asked about being called out, sometimes when it has, you know, when we're talking about something having to do with white people, I'll sometimes turn to a white student and say, Bill, you're white. Would you like to speak about, you know, the white experience, you know, about this? And I just love it because the train stops, the record scratches, right? You guys know what records are, right? I'm joking. But it's this moment where they're like, wait a minute. Oh yeah, that doesn't really work. You know, everyone finds that to be hilarious. Why would the other side of that not also be hilarious, right? But it goes back to a fundamental principle having to do with race, which is race, I think, if we understand it properly, what's so reprehensible about it is the way in which it obliterates individual identity by making a person's group identity the primary way in which we know them, okay? I don't need to know much about you because I look at your hair, eyes, skin tone, height, or whatever it might be, okay? And therefore, I don't actually need to penetrate that to get beyond that to actually figure out who you are. And so I think one thing we always need to remember, okay, first of all, we also need to, and I hope we talk about this later, but we always need to have an eye toward not just thinking about educating in our classrooms about race. We're talking about race now. It's not just about talking about what, you know, groups of color, right, BIPOC groups haven't gotten, but what white groups have gotten. Okay, that has to be part of the discussion, right? Because if we don't do that, then we're actually constructing whiteness as this sort of innocent identity. But I swear I'll get to the point. The final point here is the best anecdote to being caught trying to call out someone to speak for their race is as a teacher. You need to cultivate a relationship with that student. It protects you from doing that because the more you know that student, the more you know that that is an individual person with their individual hopes and dreams and needs, and they have their own perspective on things. They're not just some monolith. They're not just some spokesperson for that just takes all the uniqueness out of that person. How terrible that must be. That never happens to me. Can't imagine what that must be. Right? What a terrible thing to do to someone in the classroom, right? That should never happen. But the other thing is also true. We shouldn't, in our attempts to understand our students as an individual, ever for a minute begin to think that their racial identity doesn't matter, that it isn't a primary way in which their lives are structured at school and in the larger society. So somehow walking that balance is really hard, really necessary.
Stephanie, I do have one more thing about that. I do like your idea, but I've been teaching at this high school for 20 years. That approach is a good Band-Aid short-term fix. Callie, if you remember, we had Mr. Zellner come in when we did the Harlem Renaissance and we talked about Black identity, and it was so powerful. I had kids write about that when I was dealing with a recommendation. He said that was the most powerful piece of the classroom was Mr. Zellner. Came in. Basically, Mr. Zellner lives in Bedford. He was got locked out going through his window. And of course, the neighbor called the cops on him and it was a big deal. And it was hurtful. What made it really powerful, Stephanie, was the fact that Mr. Zellner was there telling the story and they could see how emotional he was. And yeah, bringing in speakers. And we should always be doing that. And I like to think I do currently do that. But that is just a temporary fix. I'm at the point in my career where I want to see minorities as teachers before I retire. I've been here that long that I'm starting to think about that now. And it is a priority. It can't be, hey, let's just make this checklist all right, we have Mr. Zellner coming in, did that. Let's do something on women's suffrage, did that. Let's get a primary source. That's not good enough anymore. That needs to be something that is done all the time, not as a response to a horrific incident. So I think the most important thing, once again, is about how, and this is for me, my agenda. Before I retire, I need to see more minority teachers in the classroom, because when Mr. Zellner left, there was no Black teacher there. He came in, and then when he was gone, it was me and Mr. Spence. That's it. So that's the other point. The next day, who's there? That white teacher again, for the most part. So I think, again, if for me personally, being in this school for 20 years, seeing Mr. Zellner and Mr. Moss retire without any real discussion about, man, we're losing two African-American teachers. This is monumental. What do we do? This is an emergency, because it should have been viewed that way. So I'm at the point again where I think that if we do not collectively as a community find a way to get minority teachers into this school, we will be having these wonderful discussions that may not materialize into actual growth. And that's why when Akshay, you emailed, like, yeah, of course, I'd love to be on it, because that's what I am advocating now. Like I said earlier, the teachers that I teach with are some of the most respectful, you've seen it, intelligent, admirable, compassionate. My God, they're so amazing. It gives me, and please don't take it the wrong way, but it gives me faith in white people working at the school. It gives me hope. And I think you got to be a minority dude to say that. That gives me hope. You know, looking at, I remember Twice Told Tales. It was such a powerful year. My son was in it too, so that was a big part of it. But, you know, the growth that I saw out of these students when it came to seeing the world more universally, a 17-year-old, and I said this to them the last class, we got all emotional, it was great. I was like, you guys give me hope and faith in this country. You do. You are the ones that give me hope. So I just think it's bigger than just what is our curriculum. It's bigger than that for this high school. 20 years, and we really haven't seen that many minority hirings. And that is a shame. And that is something that should be shouted out into the public as much as humanly possible. Why do we not have minority teachers at Concord Carlisle? So I love your idea, Stephanie. It's a great idea, and it does work, but that's not the long-term fix that I think would solve anything.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with you about hiring more minority teachers, Mr. Rivera. And so just sort of as we wrap up here, we had one more idea that we wanted to touch upon, which was the idea of adding more electives that talk more about people of color and the struggles that they've faced and, you know, their successes in history. And we were wondering how possible and how effective you guys think it would be to implement electives of that type.
Electives take several years to plan just as a logistical issue. If there was a particular elective that you thought the social studies department should consider teaching, I think we'd listen. If the students wanted to, I was going to say come to a meeting, but we don't really have those anymore, come to a Zoom session. I think some of our classes, like Mr. Gauthier's class, deals with race as a really important structure, and it's a huge part of the discussion of sociology. I know Mr. Rivera's class as well, Twice Told Tales, and he can speak more to that. So I can speak obviously most particularly about con law, which I teach, which a few of you have taken. And we do talk about race in the context of several cases, and we talk about gender and women's rights in the context of Roe. I think one of the things I try to teach in that class is sometimes the limitations of the legal structure, because it's an inherently conservative and elite-dominated structure. And so while Brown v. Board was a watershed decision, and in and of itself, it wasn't enough. And I think Mr. Rivera made that point earlier, as did Mr. Gauthier, about let's not just check some boxes and say, okay, we've desegregated, but there's a difference between desegregation and integration. So I hope that through some of the cases, I'm able to bring certain conversations into class about both about how the legal structure works and how legal analysis works, and about the limitations of that as the only way towards societal progress. Usually the courts are a part of it, but they can't be all of it. And sometimes my students come into class thinking Brown v. Board, the Supreme Court's awesome, but generally it's a pretty conservative body. And I mean that in terms of not promoting significant and revolutionary change. Occasionally, yes, but outside of the Warren Court, not especially. And so I think, and I think the international issues class tries to take a more global perspective on problems. So there's some focus in some of the electives that we already have, and people don't take all of them. So it's hard for everyone to know what's in all the other ones. I think if there's a particular thing, we always, every couple of years, we do a review of the electives we teach to think about whether or not we want to add or subtract. And so if there was one that you thought, you know what, the one thing that I really miss and would have liked to know in social studies that I probably couldn't read on my own, or I don't want to read on my own, that I want to be part of this school community, then this is a great group. Write it up, and you know, ask to come to a meeting. We'll, speaking for myself, I think we'll listen. I have faith that the department, I agree with Mr. Rivera, that we will, it might not mean an immediate change, as in, you know, the schedule's already set for this year, but we will listen and we will think about either A, using one of the electives we already teach to talk about topics that you think are important, or B, talking about integrating and adding a whole new elective, which would take a little bit longer, but which has happened over time. We have added new electives. Not all of them go back to the 1990s the way constitutional law class actually does. I inherited that class. I didn't create that class. But some of them, like geography, Ms. Winkler's geography, that's a new class. We added that class. Twice Told Tales. Mr. Rivera, together with Mr. Spence, worked really, really hard, hours and hours of meetings and outside reading to create that class. So it is possible to do. And if you have a specific idea, let us know. Send Meredith Fisher, who is our current department chair, an email. And we'll invite you to a meeting.
And so, AJ, first off, it's great seeing you, man. I haven't seen you in a while. Good to see you. You know, I do think what's also important that was touched upon is it has to, these classes, for them to be successful, it takes some time. And there sometimes is a knee-jerk reaction to just push something forward. So, you know, I think what if you do have an idea in a class that you think needs to be taught, then we do need to hear your voice on that. But also, it can't be just forced. What I think makes our department so special is that people teach what they have a passion for. I teach psychology because, well, Ms. Fox volunteered me for a psych class about 20 years ago, and I knew nothing about it. And I had to study my butt off for a whole summer just to be able to narrowly teach it. But I developed a passion for it. And I wanted more, and I ended up getting a master's in it. World religions, I've always had a passion for. So I saw Twice Told Tales as a way to extend that passion. And, you know, Ms. Fox was not joking around. Alex and I spent 5 years before one class was taught, 5 years researching it, trying to get it approved. Don't forget the numbers. How does it get scheduled? The administration. So, you know, a school is a bureaucracy, and it took some time. But I do think, JJ, your question is really important because of the time that we're in right now. It seems like it would be advantageous for us to maybe listen to the student's voice, figure out a class that we think would really satisfy just the whole kind of mess that we're in right now, but also take the time to develop it correctly. because that I've inherited classes before that I didn't really know much about, and it's a mess, versus Twice Told Tales, which we took about 5 years before we first taught. And I would honestly say it's the fourth year going at it, and the best version we've ever taught was the one Callie got, because you just get better and better at it. So that's the other thing. I remember being a teenager, we want that. I want this class now. I said, well, okay, it's a great idea, and let's develop it properly. So that would just be a little bit of advice as well, okay, that you want it done right. You want the teachers that have the passion for it, that have trained for it, have done the summer work, have done the reading for it. Then you got yourself a high-quality class that's needed.
I'll throw something in there as well. I think a lot about electives, and I think the question was, could we have a class where we could address themes of race more specifically? And that, I think it's probably true that those classes do. It's a lumbering process. I'll just say that. But I mean, it would be good if we could get something developed. I think maybe when I think about a class, and I'm not sure I'd be the person to teach this necessarily, but I would love to see a class that actually took advantage of some of the facts at CCHS. So I'll just go back a step. You know, sometimes I think when we think about our student body and we think, and I'm just going to talk for a second about the MECO program, which I think is, it's actually one of the reasons I wanted to come to teach at CCHS. It's I think going back to my days as a student at CCHS, it's for me, one of the most important things about the school. Best things about the school. I think sometimes though, when we talk about it, it's like, oh, METCO, we want to raise the GPA, and it's, we talk about it sometimes like it's a problem to be solved, right? And yes, there are issues there. I also think though, seen from a particular perspective, I think actually METCO is the solution to a problem we don't oftentimes talk about, which is the incredible segregation and social isolation of white people in the suburbs, right? And I think that one thing I would love to see in an elective is like a dialogues course, in a course in which students from different backgrounds actually were able to come together, maybe not a course led by a teacher, but facilitated by a teacher, where we were looking at some texts in common and actually through discussion, through breaking them down, through maybe even doing projects together, then perhaps this could be a fruitful endeavor for sort of all the students at CCHS in terms of enhancing their knowledge base, in terms of developing relationships with people they wouldn't necessarily develop relationships with, in terms of getting a sense of who they are, in terms of where they stand. And I think, what would be really interesting about a course like that also, JJ, is that, think about the name of your club, this club called Intersections. It's a fact, right, that we don't just live one dimension of our identity at a time. Right, I couldn't say to Joseph, Joseph, you're a black man, right? Or you're African American, right? Because you're also male, right? You're also gay. I mean, there are all these parts, and you're living them all at once, right? And any real thorough analysis of social identity and where we stand has to see it not as this identity and that identity, but a matrix, and we fall along all these different lines. And one of the cool things about CC is that we actually have made some strides. When I was a student at CC, we didn't have spectrum. The culture around sexuality was very different. I'll just say that. There's more openness there. We have work to do, but it's better, I think, than when I was a student. And I would love a class that actually explored, some of these intersections of identity and gave students a chance to learn from each other in a meaningful way through dialogue, some common readings, maybe chosen by the students. Here I am designing an elective. This is a terrible idea. but I've thought about this a lot, and that would be a great senior class that could bring students together. Because I think sometimes what happens at CC is we have, as we said before, we have students that hail from different backgrounds, but instead of really meaningfully interacting, we have a lot of observing and decontextualized observing. I see you, I see things you do I don't necessarily understand. And if we don't have a conversation about that, what happens is people go back to their corners and they kind of develop their own mythologies about what they're seeing, which oftentimes are wrong and sometimes are destructive. The more we can bring students together to talk and explore some of these things, I think the better, especially now in this moment of just incredible divisiveness and you know, I think that would be a worthy addition. So JJ, I would say, what a great idea. Let's add more to it, right? And let's maybe make it more, you know, developed by students and more dialogue based. I don't know. Maybe that doesn't appeal. I don't know. But I think that might be cool.
I would just add one thing, is that the work that you're all doing is probably more important than any single class we add to the elective program. That the speaking that you're doing, the articulation of your ideas, the expression of your identities, the group that you've created will outlast you in this institution, and will have a lasting impact both on the faculty and on the student body. And in terms of creating better human understanding, mutual respect, welcoming of people from different backgrounds, not just focusing on someone and expecting the Mekjaya to be the standard bearer for their race in every situation. In all of those, actually, you probably would have more impact on the entire dialogue and discourse within the peer culture of the school, which is as important as the academic culture of the school in making people feel welcome and like it's a home for them, than any individual teacher can do. So I think it's a really interesting idea, JJ. And I also think that you have more impact collectively than any single teacher might have. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for well saying said. That. Oh,
no. No, I just said well said. That was awesome. That's all.
We are coming to a close, but yeah, I think I realized through our club how important intersectionality is. I've learned so many different perspectives, how like the same curriculum affects different people differently just based on their own background. And I think, you know, as teachers and with the curriculum, it's similar to how we spoke with the English teachers last 2 weeks. The curriculum can have a lot to impact someone's biases and lessen their prejudices. So it's really important that we're having these conversations, and I'll hand it off to Vicky to close.
Yeah, so thank you all for speaking with us today. I know we're all really grateful that you guys had the chance to come on during your summer and speak with us for this time. For the audience to know, if this is your first time listening, or if you'd like to listen to more of our episodes, they're all on wiqh.org under the special shows tab. You can stream all of our other episodes, including the last one, episode 3 with the English teachers. And then also, if you want to stay up to date with like everything that we're doing, you can also follow us on CCHS Intersections at Instagram. So yeah, thank you so much. It was really interesting to hear all of your thoughts and have this conversation. Thank you.